Welcome to Write or Die Ghosttober, where we talk to authors who write spooky, scary, or disturbing books and find out all about their writing process and how they keep readers hiding under the covers.
So you were on a big panel at Comic-Con, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so weird for how I see anything that I'm involved in, because I'm like, well, if I'm involved in, and then it's like a cute, small, like indie thing. But no, there were amazing people on the panel. There was Zoraida Cordova, Adam Solera, who we've obviously talked about before, and we love Zoraida too. And then Rebecca Roanhorse, who I have so much love and respect for her books, and I'm so excited actually for her middle grade coming out with Rick Riordan Presents. So it was amazing to like be on a panel with current YA powerhouses, to be honest. So, and at New York Comic Con of all places.
I know, that's a huge deal. It's really funny too, because like, I think we've sort of went through this journey together from like people sort of asking us like, oh, what are you working on? Or like, how do you know each other? Or just random like little questions that it would be like, oh yeah, I'm an author and this is my book, to now like being on panels where we're invited to talk about them. But it's really funny because when I specifically remember like more than once at Books of Wonder where people where Kat would like be like, oh, this is Clarabelle, like she has a book or whatever, and then she just would like go silent and like not say like, and I'm also an author. And it's so much easier, I feel like, to talk about our friends and like hype them up. And I think it's like, if you're not used to it and if you're not an extrovert, which is most writers aren't, I think it's a muscle that you need to sort of like work on, to like talk about yourself and your own books, like just at conferences and on panels and stuff. It can feel a little bit cringe in the beginning.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's a skill that you have to develop no matter what. I'd say that in the past we've definitely said like, when it comes to social media platform or like having an author website or any of those things, most things are definitely considered optional. But I'd say one of the things that has the most direct, in my mind, like influence over audience interaction and whether people actually are interested enough to buy your book after the fact is in-person discussions, especially if you're lucky enough to be invited to a conference or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's an invaluable opportunity. And also just, you know, in this conversation about panels and conferences, let's just acknowledge the fact that it is a privilege and there's a lot of financial barriers. So if you're publisher's not sending you, then of course that's going to be a huge issue. And of course, if you're not traditionally published, there's all additional barriers to your opportunities to pitch yourself. So, but setting that aside, just talking about going to conferences or going to events and being able to talk about your book, it's a skill that I think every author, you know, no matter where you are in your journey, should be able to develop. And no one really talks about it that much. But it's definitely a huge part of being an author in this day and age. And it's definitely like a terrifying prospect for so many people who are introverts in general. And I'm still learning, to be completely honest. But I will say, well, it's funny because after the panel, I was telling everyone who I was on the panel with, because I had the opportunity to like talk to them. We went out for drinks after, which was really fun. But I was like, oh my God, I was so nervous. And they're like, oh, it didn't show. And I was like, thank you so much. And they said, you know, maybe it's because you have a podcast, because you and I are used to talking about issues because we have a podcast. And so I actually think, like, not that everyone should start a podcast, but another thing that I think friends of mine have said really helped them is doing Insta stories.
Okay.
Or AMAs on Instagram, because it's like your personal channel. And, you know, if you want to do it where you record yourself talking, or even if you don't want to have your face, like, you know, I know some people who like the video is like of just like their book, like they're video recording their book, but they're talking over it.
Right.
And they're answering questions. And it's just like a way for you to learn how to speak out loud about your book and your author journey. And the great thing with Insta story that I think is it's gone after 24 hours. So it's not like a permanent thing that's out there. So you can grow and develop with it. And it's just a way for you to practice. I think it's just a really smart way to get used to it.
Right. And you also don't have to record it and post it if you don't like it. You can record it and look at it and make sure it's okay and then post it if you feel comfortable. So it's not like you have to be on live either. You can like just do it like pre-recorded type things if you feel uncomfortable. So I definitely think that's a really good tip for people to take into account.
Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing is that sometimes when I'm given like these tips and tricks by other authors, it's like, wouldn't have thought of it myself, but as soon as they say, I'm like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. Right. Like when I first heard the Instagram advice, I was like, that does make a lot of sense. But unfortunately, the ways I've gotten the advice is that I've been at a conference and gotten the advice. So like for somebody who is just starting out and doesn't have the opportunity to go and personally interact with people at this point, like, you know, what are you going to do to prepare once you are invited? And it's great advice. But then if you are getting it after you've already like fumbled, then you kind of feel like, oh, man, I wish I knew this before. So, yeah, that's my hope with this is just like, I think people should know. And if you haven't been to a conference yet, then maybe you can start now practicing if you want to, talking about your book through like other mediums that are free and available to you at this time.
Yeah, for sure. It is important. And especially if you already know that it's going to sort of make you anxious to talk about your books or you're worried about it. If you prepare yourself mentally, it's like when you're going to a restaurant and there are certain things you can't eat, like looking at the menu beforehand can help because you can mentally prepare yourself. Like these are the things I can eat and these are the things I can't eat, you know? So if you're sort of like already have it in your head, like these are the things that I'm going to do, it makes you feel less nervous and more prepared. And then you're less likely to, you know, say something weird or just like, or to feel embarrassed, even if you don't. Cause I feel like sometimes also we think that we sound a lot worse than what we actually do.
True.
Ryan LaSala was, talking about this on Twitter, like in a sort of joking way, but also in a way that I feel like resonates a lot. And he was talking about how he was at like an event and he was so being social and like, now it's time to go home and like pick apart everything I said and see if I sounded dumb. And it's like he said it in a way that was humorous, but I feel like a lot of authors actually do that and like feel that way. Like you go home and you sort of analyze, like you hyper analyze everything that you said and you did and all your interactions. And if you're anxious, you might think like, oh my gosh, I sounded so bad. I feel like most of the time, like people who are actually so sort of analytical and criticize themselves so much aren't the ones who are like making these big faux pas anyway. It's usually people who are like, I'm great and it's whatever. But if you're always constantly worried about what you're saying, like I feel like you're gonna be okay. And also like most people are so worried about themselves at these events, like they're not gonna be nitpicking everything that you say or do, you know? A lot of it is pressure that we put on ourselves and that we worry about when we're fine. So this is like a little pep talk. I think that you're probably doing a lot better than you think you are already if you think you're messing up. But yeah, it's good to practice. I think it's definitely good to practice. It can't hurt, especially when it comes to panels, because you know, you're sort of like on the spot on a panel. And I know I've been intimidated before, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be on this panel. Whenever I'm on a panel with Justin, I always get worried because Justin's so smart. I'm like, everything I say is going to sound like I'm in kindergarten because Justin Reynolds, he's so smart. But it's always fine. It always ends up being so great. And it's just like something that you just have to work on and think about. Maybe write down little notes of things you can say beforehand if you're worried about not having anything to contribute.
Also, for me personally, when I'm answering some questions, it's just to make sure that I can stand completely behind my answers, I always try to kind of just frame it in from my experience or the reason I did this. So it's not like, oh, when you're writing YA fantasy, then you have to do this, you know, that kind of a thing. And you know, I think, not saying that I think it's inappropriate if anyone does frame it like that, but for me personally, I think that it's the same thing as you. I've heard so many inspirational, like more prolific authors who've just been around for a lot longer talking about these things in such inspirational ways. And I know already that at this point in my career and the way that my personality is, that that's just not a type of platform that I could imitate. It's just not where I am right now, especially in my experience and in my confidence. But I am confident in talking about my own experiences because they're my experiences. So I kind of just lean into that more because it's just my comfort zone. And I think that's the thing, though, is that everyone has a different comfort zone. So finding that is really important. And just using that as kind of a rule of thumb for yourself, I think it'll just make it a lot easier for you to talk about things.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that what you said was important. Like, it's not where you are right now. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to have all of these, like, really. And honestly, like, not to, like, I'm not just saying this because you're my friend and we're on a podcast, but I think you do really well when you speak on panels. I understand what you're saying. When I've seen, like, DJ Older or, like, someone like that speak on a panel, or even when I moderated that panel the one time that, like, Leigh Bardugo was on and Jason Reynolds was on, and I was like, holy crap, these people are brilliant. But the thing is, they've been in the game for so much longer. They have so much more experience to pull from, not only being an author, like, in their own right, but also doing panels and being in front of people. So it's like, it really is a muscle. So I think that even like, if you're an author starting out and you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be as brilliant as these people who are on these panels, I think that that's doing a disservice to your potential, because it's because you're just starting out. Like, you don't know what you're going to have to say and the things that you're going to be able to pull from a couple years from now. I can definitely say that when I first started out writing, I didn't have half of the opinions that I have now about things. And it's because I've been in the world for a while. So I've been able to sort of like cultivate the things that I feel about different topics. But if you had put me on a panel in 2014, I would have been like, duh. I wouldn't have had anything to say at all. So where you are now in terms of talking about your books to people and on panels, it doesn't mean that that's where you're always going to be.
Yeah, for sure. And then also, if you're a person who just like is such a nervous speaker when it comes to public speaking, I do think that maybe just making yourself a list, or, you know, not just by yourself, like you can ask your agent or your editor or your critique partners, what are some very common topics that are discussed in panels in general when it comes to like the type of genre, type of stories that I write, and just figure out your general answers to it. Like, I have general answers of how I want to discuss like the cultural representation in my book, or the inspiration because I'm very inspired by Korean dramas, or like how I do world building or how I do character development. So even if I don't have something, you know, mind altering to say, I at least have like a foundation, because I know why I think the way I think about these things. And it's fine if you don't know why you do what you do, because right. Writing is such a like a organic process, but trying to just like think those things through really, really does help, because then you're not just rambling and then in the last minute you're like, oh wait, I think I meant this the whole time.
Right. And you know what? A lot of times you might think that you won't be able to find insightful things to say, but you're when you're on a panel, you're up there with other people, you know, you have co-panelists, you can jump off of things that they said and sort of just have a conversation, just think of it as a conversation. And in terms of like having set things like that you want to talk about, I would say another helpful thing is really having like sort of a concise pitch for your book. So just moving away from panels, just talking about your books in general, like being able to say like, hey, yeah, I'm an author. People are going to, the first thing they're going to ask you when you say you're an author or someone else says you're an author is, oh, what's your book about? It's always the first question. If you can make like a short, like Twitter pitch sized, like elevator pitch for your book, like a couple of lines that you can just say quickly and sort of memorize, that'll be hooky and sort of get people interested, because you never know who you're going to be saying this to, that's really helpful too, just to have like a quick pitch memorized, so when people say, what's your book about, you're not like and rambling for like 10 minutes and not sure what you're saying. Because it can be, you can totally have like a great pitch, like, and know what your book is about, but when someone puts you on the spot, it can be hard to think of it, especially if it's like an author you admire or somebody who you look up to, or even just like anybody that you don't know, like a stranger or in a social setting. If you're nervous, those words can really sort of elude you in that moment. So I would say having like a quick, like really just two lines, like memorized, of how you could pitch your book really quickly. Even if you're using comps, you could just be like, oh, it's this meets this, and this and this and this happens. And just like a quick thing. And that's usually enough. Because I feel like that's the question that can make you freeze if you're not prepared for it. Especially if you're a newer writer. I feel like pitching your book in the beginning can be really difficult.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, this is really interesting because on our Patreon, we have an Ask Us Anything. And there's a question that has to do with conferences. So we figure that'd be a nice tie-in to this, how this discussion has developed.
Absolutely.
Look at us.
What a smooth segue.
We're professional.
All right.
Okay. Actually, this is less about being an author guest at a conference and more about conferences, I believe, writing conferences.
Okay.
So this person says, I'd love to hear you guys discuss writing conferences, the pros and cons, and the different types. If one is privileged enough to attend one, what can or should they expect? If a conference includes an agent workshop or roundtable where writers are encouraged to ask a lot of questions, are there particular questions we should be asking? I've attended a decent amount of conferences and workshops, and I believe you have as well. Right, Clarabelle?
Not really, to be honest.
Well, you did the highlights. You did highlights.
Yeah, that was pretty much my first conference, like workshop, that I went to that wasn't something I was there for work. So, yeah.
Okay. So I guess I'll just answer really, really quickly, because at the end of the day, everyone, when you attend, if you're attending a writing conference, it's all dependent on where you are, right? In your journey and in your skill set. So I definitely think that you need to assess like what you think you need in terms of developing more as a writer and developing your professional career. Oftentimes people going to conferences are either trying to get an agent or they're trying to pitch their book to editors that are accepting unsolicited submissions. So I think that that's obviously a concrete goal. But when it comes to being able to ask questions during like workshops, roundtables, things like that, I definitely think you need to have an understanding of where you are currently within your skill set, what you think your strengths are and what you think your weaknesses are. I don't know if there's a particular question you should be asking at a workshop or a roundtable, other than, you know, what I was just saying, what you've assessed is your personal needs. I will say that when I've gone to Q&As where there's an agent and people are so obviously like trying to pitch their book without actually pitching their book and framing it as like, oh, it's a question, it gets really awkward. I think that, you know, agents are – they're inundated with a lot of people at this conference like really wanting to get their attention and wanting the opportunity to pitch their work. And agents are aware of that before they go to these conferences. But I think there's always a time and place for it. So being respectful for like those professional boundaries is actually a really big deal. And being able to prove that you have that ability is will go a long way if and when you do get the chance to pitch your book to that agent or editor and try to create that actual professional connection. You know, if you have the opportunity to sign up for individual pitch sessions, definitely do so. A lot of these pitch sessions will give you a certain allotted amount of time. They'll tell you ahead of time. It'll be like, you have 8 minutes, you have 10 minutes, you have 15 minutes to talk to the agent. It does not take 10 minutes to pitch your book. So what I would say is that figure out like a quick 2-minute pitch. And 2 minutes, I really mean this. Limit your actual pitching time where you're reciting or whatever the thing that you've come up with to 2 minutes. Because if you're taking longer than that, then it could indicate that you don't have an idea of how to boil your book down. And if you can't pitch it, then how could the agent eventually pitch it? And it might mean that your book itself is messy because you don't understand like the quick pitch for it. So really try to limit your pitch to 2 minutes. And then what I would do is take the other 6, 8, you know, 12 minutes of the time you have allotted to kind of just discuss things about the book, allow the agent to ask you questions. A lot of times an agent will ask for clarification, and that gives you a lot of time to go into the nitty gritty. And then the questions that I think you should have available to yourself after the fact is like talking to them about their own practices of being an agent. You know, as an agent, like, do you encourage your clients to do X, Y, Z with their career? How does that work? How does the process work? This is what I'm interested in for my career. Like, you know, any advice on that? Those types of things. Obviously, do not be asking them to give you actual, you know, don't ask them to work for you yet. Don't be like, okay, well, this is what I want to do next. And this is, should I work on this manuscript next or this manuscript next? Don't do that. But I did things like, oh, you know, I'm also working on a middle grade, but do you think that because I really want to focus on young adult, like I really should just be working on the young adult in order to get my foot in the door? And they would be like, yes, you know, that kind of a thing. Yeah. So in general, those are my quick and dirty tips and tricks for things to do at a conference. And then the other thing I'd say to do at a conference, make friends.
Yes.
Because the best thing you can get out of conferences and in-person events is networking and people who can support your career afterwards, even outside of agents and editors. Making friends, getting critique partners, critique groups, support, it's invaluable. And doing it face-to-face is easier.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree with everything that Kat said. I will also say, like, I'm more on the sort of practical self-care side, because that I can sort of give a little bit more insight into. I would say some of my tips would be wear really comfortable shoes, and also to bring a snack with you. Like, there's been so many times where I see writers getting really overwhelmed. Like, their blood sugar is low, they're freaking out, they're just, it can be really anxiety inducing sometimes, especially if it's your first conference. So bring something like Gatorade with you, or like a protein bar or something that you can sit down and sort of like eat, if you're feeling like overwhelmed or like dizzy or whatever. That can really help. I've had to rescue many writers in that predicament. Also, another thing that helps, if you're going to a big conference and you know that you're anxious, or you might get lost easily, usually every convention center has like a map of the event on their website normally, especially for bigger shows. Like, I know BookCon does this, and Book Expo. You can actually go on their website and you can see like a whole map of where everything is. Sometimes the Wi-Fi doesn't really work really well in these kinds of places, so if you have like a printed out piece of paper, it might help you be able to navigate better, especially if you're running around, if you have an agent event and you don't want to be late for it. That could be something that helps you and helps the event run a little bit more smoothly for you.
Definitely. I mean, conferences are overwhelming in general, and especially if you're nervous about something, it's just nice to like pre-prepare things to make you as comfortable as possible. So I agree. We have another quick AMA that I think we can cover, because we kind of already answered a question similar to this. So I just figured we'd just quickly give some thoughts. And then we also have a guest shout out. So, So the AMA is just about, when do you know you're ready with your manuscript? So they said, while polishing your manuscript to query, how did you know you were ready? I've done 2 rounds of developmental edits so far. I feel quite happy with my story, and I want to move on with polishing character voices and expanding on my world building. I think I'll be ready to query then, but I don't know. Should I seek more betas and specifically ask them, hey, will you check a book like mine out of the library? Any feedback is greatly appreciated. So we did kind of answer, when do you know your manuscript is ready thing, but do you want to kind of give your quick answer?
I mean, I think that at a certain point, you have to go with your instinct. If you think it's ready, if you think that you did your absolute best to make it the best book that it could be, and you don't have any lingering sort of doubts in the back of your mind about it, And I will also say that you have to be careful with that because you can fall into the trap of sort of like forever revising and just continuing to revise over and over again. The book is never going to be perfect. That's one thing that you have to acknowledge. But you also have to sort of sit down with yourself and say, I made this the best that it could be. And if you feel like you need a beta reader to tell you their opinion, then that's fine. I'm of the thought that too many opinions can really muddy my sort of grasp on where the manuscript is. I think it's different for everybody, but I like to try to limit it to three beta readers or CPs per manuscript if I can. Two is even fine. I think that there are people who feel more comfortable with a lot of different people giving them feedback. I don't, because I think everyone's always going to give their own opinion and it can pull you in a lot of different directions. That being said, really the thing that it tells you if your manuscript is ready is you. Like there's no kind of like bell that dings when the book is ready. Unfortunately, I wish there was, that would be really cool.
Oh my God, that technology,
except if the bell never rung and then you'd just be like, but why? but it's just on your gut and your instinct. And if there's something that's really gnawing at you and you feel like there's like a problem with it, then usually that instinct is right. But it's sort of, if it's just sort of like a vague, like, I don't know, but I tried my best and I did everything that I could to make this book good. Sometimes the only way to really know is to start querying it. And when you reach that point where you really did your due diligence and like you revised and you got at least one other opinion and you really feel like the book is strong, query it and agents will let you know.
Yeah, I mean, it stinks because it's so subjective, right? So, yeah. Which I swear to God, every single, I use the word subjective way too much, but it's because it's like the theme of publishing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think that that's why a lot of times you'll hear a person's querying strategy is to do it in small waves, because then if the feedback you get really does ring true to you, then you do have other opportunities to make it stronger and then send it out to more agents. So right. I think that, you know, instead of being so sure your manuscript's the best in the entire world, like without a doubt, it's more like you have a strategy that can address if there, it can be strengthened, you still have the opportunity to do that. And I think having a strategy like that can like kind of help to ease any nervous energy that can come with the idea of querying agents.
Yeah, it can be scary. And I think sometimes we do sort of look for that thing that's going to be like the one sort of indicator that our book is ready to go. And the sad truth about it is so subjective. Even within our own opinions of things, we can sometimes be like, I'm not sure. and sometimes at that point you just have to take the leap and just go for it. I would say never query a first draft, you know, never query something that you've only done copy edits on. Like that's not revising, you know. I think those are a lot of like sort of new writer mistakes, because it can feel like such an adrenaline rush when you finish a book for the first time and you believe in it so much. But you have to look at it like everybody thinks their baby is the cutest baby in the world, right? But that's super subjective. It's your baby. You made it. Of course, you're going to think it's cute. That's like what nature makes you do, so you protect it. So that's not necessarily true. So just really look at it through that lens and just try your best to make it really good. And sometimes a book can be the best that you can make it and it still doesn't get anywhere because you have to understand how the market works, and the market doesn't take a book based on its merit all the time, unfortunately, especially for marginalized writers.
Yeah. And yeah, and just like, so to go a little bit back to the original question, because this person said, I feel quite happy with my story and I want to move on to polishing character voices and expanding on my world building. I think that's a sign right there. You're quite happy with your story. That's great. Then yes, do what go forward with your plan. And the fact that you have a plan is good too. So, yeah. I think that, you know, for this person specifically, it sounds like you're going in a good direction. Definitely just continue onward until, you know, if there's ever a point where you're really thinking you're rushing it, that's like the only point where I would say, like, take a step back and consider, you know, why you feel that way. But if you're happy, then I think that's the only indicator you can really use.
Yeah, for sure. And exactly what you said, this person knows that they have to work on certain things. So you do those certain things. And like, once you feel happy with everything that you've done, then you're ready. You're ready to query it for better or worse. And then whatever happens next happens. And there, you know, I definitely queried the first time before my book was really ready in the way that it should have been. But it was a learning process. Like, I had to do that in order to become a better writer. And that's just sometimes how it goes.
Yeah. And, you know, as both of us have queried books that at this point we'd say, oh my gosh, never again. Just know that so many people have queried a book and then, in like, you know, 2 years later have been like, oh, that book was so bad. So everyone does it. It's totally fine. Don't not do something for fear of like future, you know, rejection or future pain, because, you know, then you will not survive publishing.
Yeah. Future pain is always guaranteed in publishing. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that you can guarantee is going to happen. Pain.
Sadness. Okay, publishing equals sadness.
That's our new theme song. Yeah. We have one shout out for our Patreon this week, and that's JC Sellers, who is amazing. And JC's actually one of my very first writer friends.
So funny.
Yeah, I know. We tried to get into Pitch Wars the same year with no success together. So, a long time ride or die, even though she didn't know that it was ride or die back then. But JC, thank you so much for supporting us on our Patreon. We love you.
We love you. Thank you.
Today's interview is with Carrie Maniscalco. Carrie grew up in a semi-haunted house outside New York City, where her fascination with gothic settings began. In her spare time, she reads everything she can get her hands on, cooks all kinds of food with her family and friends, and drinks entirely too much tea while discussing life's finer points with her cats. Carrie is a number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of the Stalking Jack the Ripper series and the forthcoming Kingdom of the Wicked. Carrie, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're great. We're so excited to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
Of course. So, Carrie, we're going to jump right in. Okay. Tell us, how did you sort of start writing? How did you get your first agent and your book deal? Just take us on that journey.
Okay, so it is a long journey, so I'll condense as much as possible. But it started about 2009, and I ended up signing with my agent in 2012. And that, I'll just kind of focus on that for a little bit. So if anyone's out there who has like had hundreds of rejections or written a bunch of books like me, I cold queried my agent. She requested it from the slush, and then she was doing a Writer's Digest webinar. And then I kind of debated going back and forth whether or not she would think I was like a real stalker if I wanted to take that course with her. So I got really nervous. I was like, well, how many Maniscalcos? Like, maybe I can just hide and she won't recognize the last name, right? So of course she recognized me and I felt like a total stalker. And she's like, I have your book. And I was like, oh my gosh. Long story short, that really opened up our conversations. Okay. And I did a revision for her and I was like, I am totally going to get, you know, offered representation with this. This is so cool. We're so great for each other. And then she sent me a rejection and it was like the worst thing ever. My heart broke. I was like, but we had a bond. But the cool thing is that she told me that the next time I wrote another book, to definitely not even query her, just send her the whole manuscript.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So yeah, it was really cool. So as far as rejections go, it was definitely the best ever. So I did. I wrote another book, and then I think it was my fifth book. And she read it, and we kind of signed from there. And yeah, so it was a long journey, but it was definitely worth it. So if you're getting rejections and people are slamming no's in your face and all the doors are closing, just keep pushing at it. I think that you never know. You keep knocking, one day a door will open.
So that whole sort of querying process took you about 3 years, you said?
Yeah, it took about 3 years. And then the story didn't get easy after that. I signed with her on my fifth book. We went out with two projects before I sold Stalking Jack the Ripper. And they both came super close. Like, they went all the way through on, like, the acquisitions. And so it was kind of really just heartbreaking to get through all those meetings. And then it's like, sorry, no.
Oh, gosh.
So it took a while. But I think that, in a way, it also made it that much sweeter when I did get that yes for Stalking Jack the Ripper. I couldn't believe it. And I was so happy because it was the book that was closest to my heart, with having a girl with forensic science. And yeah, so it was a long, long journey, but it was totally worth it.
That's really cool and super inspiring, because 3 years is such a long time to sort of, like, be just waiting and querying and just getting your hopes up. And
so, like, that querying process, like, getting rejection and rejection, or even if you get, like, any kind of request and then it's just a no to, it's just, it's so hard to know, like, do I have the talent? Can I do it? Am I just, you know, deluding myself to think that I should keep going?
Absolutely. It definitely is a roller coaster.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hang in there.
I feel like that should just be on a t-shirt. We should all wear it to conferences.
Hang in there.
Hang in there.
And then for, like,
the little cat.
Process. Oh my God. Yeah, that cat poster.
Just all wear cat poster t-shirts.
Oh my God.
So you did have, you did mention a zombie prep school book. So I'm going to go ahead and lightly drag you about that. Even though I would totally read that. 100% think it sounds interesting. But what do you think sort of you learned from that process? Do you think you became a better writer throughout writing those five books, learned patience? Like, do you think you changed as a writer from the first book until Stalking Jack the Ripper ultimately got that yes?
I think definitely. I think that every book can be a learning experience. And it's kind of like you have to just go through it to figure out what works and what doesn't. And I think for a while, it took me that many books to kind of figure out what my voice was or what that even meant. Because everyone always says, like, find your voice. And I was like, but this book has so much voice. But it doesn't mean that it necessarily translates to natural. So I think that for me, going through those, it kind of just kept helping me to hone everything and kind of just find myself along the way too, as cheesy as that might sound. But yeah, it took a little while. And I think with each project, I got better at character development or figuring out plotting or seeing where things kind of fall apart, or if it's world building, because everything was kind of fantasy and science fiction before I did Stalking Jack the Ripper. So it was a lot of figuring out, like, what is an info dump? What is showing and telling? And yeah, I think it was just kind of really good practice. And a fun fact is that one of the trunked novels that I had that my agent really liked and that we came close with getting yes for publishing, I actually ended up using some of those scenes in Hunting Prince Dracula when I did that. So I got to reuse them. So I was pretty excited.
Oh, that's exciting.
You never know, it could come back and you could use in the future.
That's awesome. I really like that. It gives you a hope, because it's so hard when something doesn't work out and, like, you worked really hard on it. And then to think, like, no one's ever going to read this. But it's like, no, they get to read parts of it. So that's amazing.
Forever. So yeah, I was so happy. My agent was like, hey, wait a minute, I recognize this. So I was like, gosh.
Yeah, my critique partner calls it cannibalizing yourself, which I don't know. I mean, that might be, like, a really, like, violent way of putting it, but the message is, like, you get to repurpose things that you thought were dead, which is always nice.
And it was so fun because I really liked how it got included into that book. And I was like, holy crap. Like, now that I have, like, a different understanding of this whole thing, like, revising it and rewriting it, it was just like, wow, I could make that scene polished and just shine even more. And I think it worked even better in the application it ended up with. And yeah, it was partly deadline too, like the deadline crunch. I actually, Dracula, I ended up trashing almost everything for that first draft. So it was kind of a nerve-wracking thing. I think I kept, like, one or two paragraphs from the original.
Oh my goodness. Oh, That's always like the saddest when you hear about those stories, because you're like, you had to get rid of everything. But yeah, I think like, especially because we revise so much, that I'm sure a lot of writers would be surprised about like how little from the original might be in their final manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. And that one, I think it was like, you know, the dreaded second book where,
oh yeah,
it was just, it was so hard, even though I'd done books before. It's such a different element when you have something that's published, especially because I didn't get the book deals until after they were like already out with ARCs and people are reading them. So then it's like you're trying to like almost redo what you did in the first one instead of having it be its own thing and just be natural again. So mm-hmm. It was such a scary experience, but yeah.
But that, you did it.
You definitely did. I always kind of feel bad for Audrey because of like Supernatural or like horrifying people that she runs up against. It's so much, and I just want to give her such a hug.
I'm like, I'm sorry. Yeah. I like to dream like the worst things that you could do to her too. I know it's bad. It's just, it's so bad, but it's so fun.
It's just like I definitely think that from book one, it was like hit the ground running, and then just hit after hit after hit. But she is a character who can take it, so that's really good too, I guess.
So sorry for doing this to you.
I actually really love the way that you kind of bring such a fresh perspective to like characters that are not only well known but are so ingrained within like the public consciousness, that people have a very set idea of like what Jack the Ripper, what Houdini, or what Prince Dracula should look like. And I always wondered while I was reading them if you purposefully wanted to kind of subvert any type of stereotypes for any of these characters. And if so, like, would you be willing to tell us about one of those times?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about it, especially with the research, and I think it's probably just for Hunting Prince Dracula, especially where you figure out, like, you have Vlad the Impaler, who was, you know, supposedly the inspiration for Dracula. Mm-hmm. And in Romania, he's a folk hero. And yet, how we're taught in our history classes is that he's just this bloodthirsty, like, dictator. I think that one of the things I found to be the most fascinating with that research, and what kind of helped shape with some of the other villains too, is that history is written by the victors, and you know, one person's hero is another person's villain. And it's just kind of interesting to reshape or kind of put it out there where it's like, we don't always have the full story. It's just about perspective.
Yeah.
You know,
that's so true. And that's such a great way to think about it, actually, because at the end of the day, so many of these people in your books were legitimately historical figures.
Mm-hmm. And so
it's really cool.
Thanks so much. Yeah, and I didn't know if it would translate. I didn't know if people would be like, wait, what are you saying? Like, is Vlad the Impaler not a villain in your book? I was like, what? But I think it was just really important to kind of handle it in that way where it's like, you can see that, you know, sometimes people do really bad things for good reasons or, you know, whatever it is, you know. Even though that sounds bad. And serial killers can just be charming and nice, and they could be the boy next door and you'd never know. And I think that's what makes them so creepy, is that you can see where they're coming from, and they are likable, and they're not just these monsters that we've made them up in our heads. And it's kind of almost worse
I definitely think that makes it scary. I think that's why like Ted Bundy is so mm-hmm. famous, on aside from, yeah. you know, all the things that he did. It's because he wasn't suspected because he was charming, and I guess he was like 70s cute or like 60s cute.
I look at photos and I'm like, really? Really?
So you can like, wait, really? Did they really think that? But I can kind of see. Did you guys see the Netflix one with Zac Efron?
I did.
I didn't.
I saw it. I really liked it. I thought it was like, I mean, I think Zac did an awesome job. And I really like that they didn't just make it about him, but they made it about I forget what his partner's name
wife.
Was. Yeah. I liked that they included like that perspective as such a big part of it. But part of it was that, just that sort of like how you can see somebody and how he really was such an unreliable narrator that like I almost felt like he believed his own lies.
Oh my, yeah. And I think that's it in a nutshell, where it's like, I love seeing it from her perspective, mm-hmm. because it's like, you always see these shows with the serial killers front and center. It's like from their life, from their lens. And then you had this movie from her perspective, and it was just, wow. Like, oh my gosh, like what would it have been like to be Ted Bundy's girlfriend? And you're hearing him say these stories, and it's like, obviously you know him and you love him and you don't want to believe that, but
right.
it's kind of evidence builds. So yeah, I mean, I think that was really, really creative.
Yeah,
and a good sure. way to look at it, you know, because yeah, serial killers, like what's the one guy, like the BTK killer, where it's like yeah. he was a church going guy, he had a yeah. family, like it, yeah, I don't know.
Or even the Golden State killer. Mm-hmm. Golden State? Yeah. yeah, he was a policeman. He was yeah. a cop. I mean, these people who are in authority.
Right.
Yeah, and for anyone who hasn't watched the Netflix series with Zac Efron, I recommend it. And spoiler alert, Kat already knows this because I spoiled it for her because I could not yeah. not tell someone. But just cover your ears if you have not watched it. But the fact that they didn't show any, like, him inciting any violence basically until the very last scene of the movie was so incredibly impactful.
Oh my God, I'm getting chills too. It was so good.
It was so incredibly impactful because it was like, no, like this is the famous scene that you know. Like this is the guy. He did those things. And like just like the car and the crowbar and like just the moment, because especially if you're like a murderer, you know, like all of us are, and like you yeah. know everything that happens, it's like holy shit. And it just like builds to it so perfectly. And I love that they use Zac Efron because he's just so beautiful that
so beautiful.
It just, it does trick your mind. And you're like, I don't want him to be bad. He's so pretty.
And I think that was like the whole thing of Ted Bundy too, where mm-hmm. it's like, he did have that charm and you wanted to pull for him, where it's like, you can't possibly be right. this. I mean, you're not as pretty as Zach, but come
on. Well, I think that's the thing, is that evil doesn't always look like what we're taught, you know, when we watch like Disney movies, like they're it's yeah. not always like the evil queen or like, you know, whatever. So, but that's something that I actually think that you do really well in your books, Carrie, is playing with the concept of evil and like truly showing though, like the unmasked, like nitty gritty of it. And I was just like wondering also like how you kind of incorporate that feeling of fear in your books, and like, is there a line that you try not to cross, or do you try to go like all the way? Like, what's your thought process with that?
Well, I try to keep it. I don't know. I'm again with like the Zac Efron movie. I really like getting into the psychology of serial killers and kind of understanding how do they blend into society. Like, how do they get away with all this stuff? I do. I think that it makes it really horrifying to think of them being like these sweet guys who are just family men and churchgoers and people who are bringing food to the barbecue, you know, and then they have this horrendous, violent life. So, yeah, I try to not hold back too much with that. And while I don't want it to be about the violence or kind of the shock factor of it, it's also like these people are doing really horrendous things to, in my case, women in the books. And there's no sugarcoating what they're doing. I don't want to kind of like gloss over that, where it's like, oh, you know, they're dead or they're murdered. It's like, no, they were brutalized. Like, these guys are monsters. They might look nice. They might be the guy next door, but they like make no bones about it. They're horrendous for what they're doing to people. So yeah, I try not to pull the punches with it, but I try to not get like too where it's focusing too long on any of those scenes, you know?
So, Carrie, can you tell us a little bit about your forthcoming Kingdom of the Wicked?
Oh, my gosh. I'm trying to think of what I can say. I was just working on some really fun scenes that I want to talk about, especially with all of this talk of evil. So let me think about what I can say. So it does have a demon prince.
Nice.
And it does have a witch, and it's basically a paranormal murder mystery. So the witch's sister is killed, and she kind of goes on this path for vengeance, and she's trying to track down the answers behind her mysterious death. But her sister's not the first person that's getting murdered. There's girls with their hearts getting torn out all across Palermo. And so, yeah, she finds out that there are more witches, and there's this big thing going on that she's just starting to really scratch the surface with.
Oh, oh my gosh, that sounds legitimately, Kat, does this not sound legitimately right up my alley? Like,
it's
sounds
like such a Clarabelle book. You're gonna love this book. I can
oh
already
my
tell.
God, witches and murder. I'm just very excited. I'm very excited. Like, as you were talking, like, you know when you, like, raise yourself up on your seat, like, with your hands, like, slowly, like, raising yourself up? Like, I was doing that, like, on my bed. It was just, like, raising myself up. Like, I was going to fly out the window.
No, I'm excited for the demon prince. I don't know why.
I love him. He's, like, a demon with a heart of gold, you know? He's kind of withholding his real name, but his title is the Prince of Wrath. He's a demon of war, and he's second in command to the devil. And he runs a royal house. So he's definitely, he's a bad, bad thing, but he's not real bad.
Aww. I have a soft spot for
him. Yeah, I like that a lot already.
He's a soft, bad guy. You know, he's got a good heart.
I love him.
I already love him.
He's already our son. He's our son.
Yeah. He will protect. I kind of want to just dive into some listener questions, because when we told our listeners that you were going to be a guest, they freaked out. They were so excited. The first one we have from Lizelle, and she said, with so much focus on debut authors and books, what do you do to try to keep momentum and interest and engagement with readers as you continue a series?
Oh, that's a really great question. I just really like engaging with readers on Twitter and Instagram mostly, where even if you're busy, and I mean, you guys know with deadlines, it's like they're just always, always there and looming. And it feels like the longer it goes on, the less time you have to do things, and there's just more demand on your time. But I think that it's really fun to even post stories or things that are quick snippets where it's like you can engage with your readers and not necessarily like in a promotion way, but just kind of like, here's a picture of me and my cat this morning, you know, where you feel like, I don't know, just it feels more personal and it's nicer to just get to relax online almost with your readers. So yeah, I think that just having those kind of tools and outlets where you can share snippets. I can share a screenshot of my computer and kind of teasers with things. And I don't know. I have a great time with it. I hope that readers get to have a good time with seeing some of those things too, where it's like, you take a screenshot, you zoom in. Can you read anything on this?
No, definitely. I definitely do that. Especially when I see someone's computer in like an Insta story. I'm like, ooh.
I do that too. Like, what do they have? So who knows? Maybe I'll write a rap scene and put it up. I keep debating that. I was like, should I do that in my Insta stories? I don't know. Tell Jimmy books.
Well, it sounds like you, the way that you see social media is just as a way to stay in touch with your readers, like, and just share excitement about your projects, which I actually love that.
Yeah, I love that too. And you know, it makes me wonder, like, I know that social media has its like really bad parts, but also, what did authors do like before social media?
Right? I mean, what's not? They not on Twitter? Twitter was not here. What did they do instead? Writing little snippets and paragraphs to people? Like, what happened?
Yeah, and there's tons of people, like, not on social media who are doing just fine, but that doesn't mean that the internet is not working for their books. Do you know what I mean? Even if it's not them, them it's personally engaging, right?
Yeah.
So it must have been so much harder, like, oh boy. Anyway, I'm glad I don't live in those dark times.
Right.
Those dark, dark times.
The before times. We have another question from Kara. Kara asks, your next book is historical fantasy. What was the research process like for your upcoming Kingdom of the Wicked?
Oh my gosh.
How do you go about crafting a world with a very real context and setting and integrate witches and demons? Lastly, it's a multi-part question.
It's like, okay, wait.
And she says, if this is spoilery, feel free to disregard. As someone of Sicilian heritage, did you seek to combat stereotypes of Southern Italians and Sicilians as always being in the mafia and introduce more positive representations of our culture?
Yes, I will definitely answer that last bit first so it stays fresh in my mind.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that, you know, as we're all growing more aware of stereotypes and the harmful representation in the world across the board. I feel that part of the reason that I did is that I grew up with, I mean, when you think about any Italian movie, it's like mobsters. There's the mafia. And while that has affected and touched a lot of even Sicilian American lives, it doesn't mean that that's all that is involved with Sicily. You know, it's like there's more than just the mafia. There's more than just the darkness. There's just so much vibrancy and life and so many cool things. So, yeah, I felt that it was just going to be really fun to take a book and set it there and not have it be about a crime boss, not have it be about, you know, bodies that are being left there from the mob, but, you know, different kind of things going on.
Right.
There's still bodies, but yeah, staying away from those harmful stereotypes, because I think that other Sicilian kids and other Italian kids don't have to necessarily grow up and just see themselves cast as, you know, wise guys all the time. So yeah, that was one thing.
And I mean, you have enough going on with demons and witches and murder that you don't really have time for that.
We don't have to add the crime. You know, we don't have to have like the warring families. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the other part was about the research process.
So the research was definitely, I love it. I have actually had Sicily. It's one of those things where I have a notebook and I have setting ideas and just a whole bunch of stuff where it's like, one day I'm going to get to write my book here. And my family is from Sicily. My grandfather's first language was Italian. So it's just, it's a culture that we grew up in very much more so than even some of our American stuff here. So it's always been very close to my heart for my family's reasons. But yeah, the research process has been great. There's the Capuchin Monastery, and I don't know if you guys know anything about that, but it's got catacombs, and it actually, the limestone creates mummies. So it's like bodies there. Like, you guys have to Google it. It's so cool. But yeah, I think it's like the Capuchin baby too, where it's like this little baby. And this sounds awful too, where it's like this little mummified baby, but it's like, it was like really, really a great mummy. It was preserved so well, and it's just natural mummification. So yeah, I mean, there's so many cool things that go on there. There's the palace that was, built in, I think, the 1400s, and it's a Moorish palace, and the king who was presiding over Italy at that time, his name was the Bad One, you know? So there's so many cool, cool tidbits that you get to add in. So I think really just knowing the layout of the land and kind of figuring out where you want it and then building your story up around there and kind of crafting your own myths and legends. One of the things I do before I start drafting is I kind of do lay out legends, like what did the characters grow up on? What are their stories? How do they fit into those kind of, I'll pick locations that I think are really neat. And then it's like, what can I have written about this that kind of ties it all in together? It's not necessarily from there, but it kind of, you can't tell, you know?
That sounds really cool. And like, it's like built in like scariness. And
right?
And I want to go there, but I'm also afraid.
I was like, I don't want to go there. I'm scared.
But I will read about it.
Yeah. Also, like, going to old churches, like in cathedrals and stuff, is really an experience. Like, I might sound like I'm making this up, but it's not fake. Like, it really does feel different, like in terms of the atmosphere. Like, when I went to the Gothic quarter in Barcelona, going into those like super old as hell places, I was like, there's definitely ghosts here, because it just feels very strange. Oh, yeah. And it just feels haunted. But I mean, I don't know. I feel like your place is going to be very super haunted. I'm excited about it.
For sure haunted.
For sure. Yeah, like the atmosphere is. It's just kind of already built in, and you're just kind of getting to play with what's already there. And it just, I don't know. It's magical, I think. Magical kind of way.
Magical.
There's a special skill in being able to like recognize the like natural atmosphere and magic in a place. And I think it's something that happens so much in like historical fiction, where it's like once you find the perfect place for your story, it's like so organic and beautiful feeling. So I always love that about historical fiction.
I think it's so neat. And I'm really a visual person, so I like to pull up all pictures before I really start drafting and really just kind of immerse myself in seeing what everything looks like. And yeah, it's just, it's really fun to kind of have those beautiful places, those creepy places, like just all the history that you just kind of feel it, even through the screen, like just kind of seeping through. And it's so inspiring.
So do you consider yourself a visual writer?
Oh, super, super visual. I was an art student, so I always kind of gravitate towards just having any kind of visual prop for myself. Like even when I'm writing the catacomb scenes, I'll have like my Pinterest board with catacombs pulled up and kind of be looking to describe them. And I'll have other things too. Like there's the Capuchin Monastery site and they have the whole history. Like a lot of those places have the history kind of like all kind of bulleted out for you. So mm-hmm. It's really neat. So you could see like the preparation chamber is called this. This is what they do. They have like bay leaves and hay that they stuff the body with. Like this is the desiccation process. Like, oh my gosh, who knew? So yeah, like you can geek out really, really hard with some of that stuff. And you've got the pictures to go along with it. So it's kind of just, yeah, it really feeds your muse.
That's so cool. Yeah, I'm definitely a very visual writer as well. So I very much appreciate websites like that too.
Thank you for what you've done. You are doing the Lord's work.
So Carrie, everybody who is on the podcast tells us their most embarrassing publishing story or something that they wish they'd known before they started. You can do either or, you can do both. It is completely up to you.
Like, well, my Gossip Girl meets zombies is definitely like, why isn't that good? Why doesn't anyone like this? There is vision here. But I think one of the things that I wish that I had known, especially like going into debut, is like the month before publication to just kind of give yourself some space and time to know that if it's been quiet leading up to like any marketing stuff going on before then, it's like crap hits the fan the month before, you know, where it's like all of a sudden you've got, you know, different interview questions coming up or blog tours and Instagram stuff. And you think that it's like, okay, that's not too bad. But once you start like actually having to write all that extra stuff, and if you're on a deadline for your next project, and then all of a sudden you're just like totally stressed out because there's so much work and you don't think you're ever going to get it done. So yeah, if you can just kind of start preparing yourself by writing out your own blog posts or social media stuff, like before that month mark hits, that way you're not doing your work on top of the other stuff that's coming in. That can definitely help ease some of the stress that goes on. Cause it's great. It's, I mean, it's good stress. It's bad stress. It's exciting stress, but it's still stress on your body.
Yeah, for sure. That's really good advice.
What was that word we learned about positive
eustress.
Stress?
Eustress.
Is that
it's
how
the
you,
opposite
is,
of distress.
It's stress from positive things.
Yeah, and that's no joke. I mean, that was my Lyme disease had been in remission. I didn't even know I had it before debut year. I started, like, it really broke free, and that's when I started to get really ill as debut year, because there was so much good and bad stress and just regular stress going on with how intense it can be. I mean, you don't really know what to expect, and since everybody's journey is not the same and it's always different, yeah, it just kind of can throw you for a loop. So if you're kind of going into it, just knowing that that month is going to be a little bit crazier than normal, and kind of pace yourself, and that it's okay to not have all the answers, and to kind of just make sure that you put yourself first sometimes too, because you have to be filling yourself up and recharging before you can keep giving to anybody else.
That's such good advice. Everybody listen and drink water, please. Don't
drink
make
water.
Me come after you. Carrie, thank you so much for being on the show. We both love you so much and your books, and we're so excited for Kingdom of the Wicked. I'm not going to be able to stop thinking about it now. So just be ready for me to badger you on social media, because I want to read it. Where can people follow you online if they'd like to know more about you and keep up with all your writing?
They can definitely follow me on Instagram and Twitter. It's at Carrie Maniscalco. Facebook, it's Carrie Maniscalco Author. And my website is just carriemaniscalco.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thanks for listening to Write or Die. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a review, and while you're at it, be sure to pick up Wicked Fox by me, Kat Cho, and Ghost Squad by Claribel A. Ortega.
See you next time, Wordies. And don't forget to spread the word.